Yes, it's interesting because if you look at sort of the third quarter of last year and particularly the fourth quarter, obviously the market has been under significant pressure, downward pressure, as part of the COVID pandemic. And in the last sort of last 3 to 6 months, particularly in the fourth quarter of 21, we actually started to see some signs of stabilization in the markets. And I'd like to point to maybe three sort of key indicators that help sort of illustrate that.
All right, so welcome Stephen Newbold, the National Director of Office Research for the U.S. at Colliers International. Thanks for joining the program, Stephen.
You're welcome.
So you recently produced the fourth quarter 2021 National Office Market Report. Can you summarize some of the key takeaways that you saw from that report?
Yes, it's interesting because if you look at sort of the third quarter of last year and particularly the fourth quarter, obviously the market has been under significant pressure, downward pressure, as part of the COVID pandemic. And in the last sort of last 3 to 6 months, particularly in the fourth quarter of 21, we actually started to see some signs of stabilization in the markets. And I'd like to point to maybe three sort of key indicators that help sort of illustrate that. On a national level, we closed out 2021 with a vacancy rate of 14.8%. That's still over 300 basis points from where it was at the end of the previous year. But actually, in the third quarter, there was no change. And then in the fourth quarter, it actually dropped by 10 basis points to 14.8. And yes, that is somewhat elevated for a national level. But if we put it in context of the prior recession, if you take the Great Financial Crisis of 2008, 2009, at that point, the vacancy rate sort of peaked at 16.3%. So we don't look to be headed in that direction now. And obviously, that is 150 basis points below, where we are now compared to sort of the prior peak. I think another key trend is net absorption. And what I mean by that is on a quarter-by-quarter basis, what the change in occupied stock is. So if you get more move-ins and move-outs or, more move-ins and space placed on the market, then net absorption is positive. To give some context before we get to the latest numbers, the 5 quarters that really marked the sort of start of COVID through the biggest hit on the market, if you take Q2 2020 through to Q2 2021, the cumulative net absorption at a national level was negative 153 million square feet. In the first quarter of last year, it got to, above negative 40 million square feet in the single quarter, which is by far the highest total on record. If you take it back, over sort of 20, 25 years, so you've got two other recessionary cycles. I think also as well, looking at the Great Financial Crisis, just to put that 153 in context, we had sort of 7 out of 8 quarters of negative absorption in 2008 through 2009. And that cumulatively was just over 90 million square feet negative. So again, this time around, unlike the vacancy rate, the hit to absorption in this cycle has been harder. But the encouraging news here, I think we're starting to see nascent signs of, if not recovery, certainly stabilization in the U.S. office market. This is going to be very, variations from one city to another, which we can discuss further. But if you actually take that net absorption in Q3 nationally, it was positive 3 million square feet. In Q4, it was positive 9 million square feet. Now, those aren't large numbers, but obviously, given where the market's been in the preceding 18 months, then I think that's obviously a positive sign as well. The third indicator I'd like to turn to is sublease space. One of the biggest sort of impacts in the past 2 years, especially where businesses are sort of uncertain about how much space they may need or are looking to downsize how much space they have. Sublease space on the market is a, he hit a record about 210 million square feet at the middle of 2021. And you compare that again to the Great Financial Crisis, it peaked at around about 150 million square feet back then. So we're at unprecedented levels, and we can discuss as we go through the call today what the implications of the impact of that sublease space is. The good news is that although it's modest, that total is starting to inch down. So we're about 10 million square feet now at the end, as at the end of 2021, below where the sublease space total peaked. So we're just shy of 200 million square feet of sublease space on the market. Obviously, it's very elevated by historic terms, but thankfully, it looks like it's starting to move down.
Yeah, and that I'm seeing that play out here in our market in Chicago, for example, where a lot of the folks that have downsized have already done that. They've put their space on the market for sublease, and a lot of the good sublease spaces have already gone as part of that flight to quality and things like that. So your perspective is that maybe that's been stabilized and maybe going down further?
I think it should go down further. I mean, there were two things that sort of, could drive a decrease. The first, as you just referred to, when you have that much sublease space on the market, there's actually some, much higher quality options than you'd have in like a, for want of a better word, normal phase of the market. And, where you've got high quality sublease space with quality fit outs, and a marked rental discount to direct space. Then, for a business who's still trying to sort of work out where their needs are over the next, over the next 2 to 3 years, taking quality sublease space that is, a 2 to 3 year lease term, could be an attractive option. And, what we're seeing, in terms of rents, every quarter we track the top 10 office markets in the U.S. and look at where, just in the downtown markets and CBD markets, where direct asking rates are for Class A space and where direct asking rates are for sublease space. And it varies from market to market, but over the sort of the past sort of 6 quarters that we've been tracking that, so we're going back to, mid-2020, the average sort of discount, from a direct rent to a sublease rent is about 25 to 30%. If you go to some of the cities, I'm thinking the ones, among the major markets that have the higher vacancy rates, Houston, Dallas, and your market of Chicago, I think the most compelling examples, then the discount is greater there. It can be 35 to 40%. If you come back to some markets that are tighter, LA, the Silicon Valley part of the Bay Area, then the discount is quite a bit less.
Okay. Sticking on the sublease topic, and you're just mentioning Silicon Valley. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening in San Francisco right now? And is Silicon Valley discernibly different than what's happening in the Bay Area?
Yeah, it's very interesting actually. There's actually quite an imbalance between what's happening in the two markets. If you take downtown San Francisco or the city of San Francisco itself, we talked about sort of rents, and the other thing on the sublease side is actually the availability rate. So if you take on a market basis how much sublease space there is on the market, divide that into the size of the market, then you get a sublease availability rate. It's come down a little bit, but in San Francisco itself, it's still at around 8%. To put that in context, if we go back across the top 10 markets, that average sublease availability rate is more in has been tracking in like 2.5 to 3% rate. Silicon Valley is above the average, but it's about 3.5%, which is a significant difference, obviously, compared to sort of 8%. In San Francisco, and I think one of the reasons for this is you've seen, in downtown San Francisco, you've seen a lot of large givebacks by tech firms, including, properties. I think probably the Salesforce Tower is one of the ones that's been the most notable, where Salesforce have pre-leased a brand new development and decided not to occupy. The good news there is that at the start of this year, Sephora took a sublease on around about 300,000 square feet of that space, but I think the tech givebacks, the dot-com givebacks in downtown San Francisco, have been a major contributor to that rise in sublease space. If you go to the Valley, it's different. You're still seeing tech firms signing up leases for direct space or purchasing parcels to build out future phases of campuses. And if you go back to that net absorption, there was actually quite a strong bounce back in net absorption in Silicon Valley in the fourth quarter of last year, into positive territory, whereas San Francisco, isn't really getting there yet. And I think one of the other things that San Francisco isn't seeing is, any large, any many large scale sort of new leases being signed, at this point in time. Hopefully the market will stabilize, but if you put that, you know, 8% sublease availability together with the actual direct vacancy, you've got about 20% availability in that market, which effectively is 1/5 of the stock there.
Right. Those are startling numbers. Salesforce had said they were going to downsize by about 40% with their current hybrid model. And so I guess out of that 8% of sublease vacancy in San Francisco, I'm curious how many of those are just large blocks of space, like you said, and that may or may not, you know, get absorbed quicker, right? Versus some of the markets like maybe even Chicago, where there's a lot of smaller blocks of space that could actually, you know, take longer. I don't know. I guess it depends.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just sticking on San Francisco for a while. I was actually on a call with a colleague yesterday where we were talking about the different nuances of that availability. And if you actually go to the real sort of AAA trophy space in downtown San Francisco, the vacancy rate there is only about 5%, which is, you know, compares to that sublease of 8, direct vacancy of 12, combined 20. So I think, you know, obviously the desire for the highest quality space persists. I mean, we've seen, even before the pandemic, we'd seen for several years a flight to quality. If you looked at, say, overall leasing activity on a quarter-by-quarter basis in the U.S., even in the couple of years leading up to the pandemic, typically 80% or more of that leasing volume, or certainly the net absorption, was Class A space. So, you know, you've seen a situation where companies move out of older outmoded space, but maybe take less space, obviously because of the higher rents in a higher quality asset, reconfigure the space, make it more flexible, maybe reduce how much the space per worker. And so, you know, hopefully they're not actually taking much of an increase on their property costs because they're moving out of a bigger space to lower rent to less space in a, you know, a higher end property. And I think that's something, you know, you've seen in Chicago in recent years, because you've had a continued flow of new development coming downtown. And, you know, maybe people moving out of lower class properties into the new trophy product. You know, I can't overstress the importance of a quality office space. You know, we've got the big overhanging issue on the office market is a return to the office and what the future form of working is taking. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that people will still place a lot of importance on a downtown headquarters or a major downtown office. But a big part of attracting people into the workplace, you know, we now talk of work as an experience rather than an address that you sort of go to. So those downtown higher quality assets, you know, are more amenitized, more quality space than maybe in the suburban counterparts. But also, if you take the concept of amenities on a wider basis, then you're in a neighborhood with a lot more amenity provision as well. I think the key thing is getting people comfortable with actually going back, particularly on public transportation, to go downtown.
Right, right. Those are all good points. And, you know, talking about the flight to quality, with the flight to quality comes construction, right, where you're either reinvesting in your existing space or upgrading into a new space. And the construction costs have, you know, gone up 10, 15, 20% on certain items. And then the delays through the supply chain have created all kinds of problems. So can you touch upon the construction costs and how you think that, is that baked into, you know, the numbers from the end of Q1, or do you think that's going to be affecting, because it's obviously it's requiring landlords to amortize those costs over a longer term. So I'm finding a lot more tenants going into longer term leases in order to get that $125, $135 square foot allowance that the landlord's willing to provide, but only if you get in there for a longer term. So can you touch on that?
Yes. I mean, that, you know, you basically summarized what is the case. You know, as you said, you've got a twofold aspect here. You know, you've got the rising cost of materials, but then you've got the delay in getting construction materials and a shortage of skilled labor, all of which obviously over the last, you know, year in particular, have pointed to, you know, driving up construction costs and the time it takes to fit out space. You know, we certainly moved to an environment where in the top downtown markets, tenant improvement allowances of $100 per square foot, you know, on a new lease on good space or above, are pretty commonplace. But the challenge, as you just sort of mentioned here, with that rising construction costs, then maybe what the landlord can offer, even if it is like a generous, you know, let's say $100, $120 per square foot, that may not cover, you know, the entirety of those fit-out costs. And one of the things that may do, obviously, is to, you know, lead a tenant to actually maybe take a little bit of a longer lease than maybe they were looking for to amortize those costs over the term of the lease. The other side of that also is because of the delays that are taking place, particularly, you know, if it's a supply materials for construction, then it's lengthening the time it takes to fit out space, which has a knock-on effect because as a tenant, if I'd planned on moving out on a certain date, but then I suddenly find that my move-in date to my new property is a few months down the line, then I'm going to have to stay put and pay rent on my existing property for a while, more than I'd anticipated.
Right. Very good points. Are you... So getting out of the major markets, going into secondary and tertiary markets, you know, some of these are outpacing as far as a growth percentage than some of the major markets. Can you talk about what those markets are and what they might have in common?
Yeah, I think this trend was sort of happening before COVID, particularly if we take a step to one side and just look at capital markets. You can go back over the last 3 or 4 years, and if you look at investment volumes in office assets, suburban properties have actually been accounted for a larger share than downtown assets. And I think what we were seeing coming into the downturn, and certainly through the last sort of 12 to 18 months as well, is there are what I would call certain second-tier markets, and they have a couple of common things. I think they have a large sort of tech tenant base, and they have a high quality of living that's maybe attractive to people, particularly millennials, who are dominating that sort of workforce. So, I'd look at cities like Austin, Nashville, Charleston, Charlotte, and Raleigh-Durham, as markets are outperforming. And you can look at those markets and look at actually where their vacancy is trending and where absorption is going. And they are seeing, pretty strong, positive absorption. And another city to sort of flag up, which isn't necessarily always on people's radar, but is one of the strongest performing ones, is Salt Lake City, which over the last few years has built up, and has still got a growing tech base in the area they refer to as sort of Silicon Slope. So I think outside of those markets, if we're looking at areas that are outperforming, by and large, most of the Florida markets are performing strongly as well.
And do you think that's a result of, kind of the tail wagging the dog, so the labor's moving there and then the companies are following to set up shop? Or do you think that's just kind of continuing the trend that was going on before and now it's materializing into real numbers?
I think it's both, really. Certainly early on in the pandemic, there were two or three well-publicized moves of, Manhattan-based investment banks to principally to Miami. It hasn't become sort of a major trend, but you just have those various attractions that Florida offers, compared to some other places in the U.S. And, one of the things I think we may well see there is actually when speculative development returns, then some of those markets may be sort of leading the way. I mean, certainly places like, Miami and Fort Lauderdale have got pretty tight vacancy rates compared to the national average. And, just sticking on that sort of construction aspect, what we've seen in recent months is a significant downturn in the amount of office space that's being built across the U.S. We're now like 25% below at about 120 million square feet, where the market peaked in terms of space underway about 12 months ago. And the other factor of that is obviously the largest share, and I would say 60-65% of that space that's underway is pre-committed or it's in built-to-suit development. So we're not seeing much vacant space coming to the market. There are pockets like Midtown Atlanta, downtown Chicago. I think the biggest impact is in Manhattan, where there is, there's about 25 million square feet of space underway. And obviously, leasing activity is going to have to pick up quite a bit to capture that space.
25 million square feet of office product being delivered in this year, or?
It's going to be, I mean, you know, some of the bigger projects have been out in Hudson Yards, which obviously has been the main growth area and seen a shift. And it's been a major shift in the highest rents in that market as well. It's going to play out over, some of these projects have got quite a bit of lead in time. So it's going to play out over 2023 and 2024 as well. You know, when you look at actually construction times in a dense city like Manhattan.
Okay.
But it does mean that you're going to have, you know, a sizable volume of space coming onto the market. I think maybe sort of the impact is, again, it goes to what we were discussing earlier about Chicago, is the attraction of that space is obvious. I mean, people are leasing the best quality space, but it's also the large blocks that they leave behind. And to what extent are there a surfeit of large blocks available? Or as we were talking about in San Francisco, if it's if it gets down to a small number of high quality large blocks, then they will garner a rental premium over smaller units of space.
Right. Well, you talked about some of these markets like Charlotte and Austin of the world. Those are all really driving markets, right? People drive to their offices, or they work in their neighborhoods and they walk over there. Some of the other markets like in New York, Chicago, and some others, you really have to take public transportation. You sent me some information on public transportation numbers. I believe it was in New York. What are you seeing in terms of ridership right now? And does that track with kind of the recovery generally?
Yeah, let's look at both sides of this. So we'll talk about public transportation usage, and then we'll talk about occupancy and how it varies from downtown to suburban markets. So I pulled some numbers on usage of the New York subway. And during weekdays right now, the data, I think the most recent data from about 1-2 weeks ago, it was saying that on a weekday, ridership levels were about 50 to 55% of where they were pre-pandemic. An interesting fact there is that on the weekends, they're more like sort of 60 to 65%. Maybe there's a little bit of this. Well, I'm happy to go into a restaurant, but I'm not ready to go back into my.
It's funny. I was looking at those stood out to me. I was curious about the dynamics of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a series of press articles on, maybe the greater willingness to enjoy the amenities. Looking anecdotally at where I am in Washington D.C., and I was talking to a colleague in Boston yesterday as well. I think that certainly, our take is that maybe the trains at peak time are at 40 to 50% capacity of sort of pre-COVID. But I think the other factor of this, if we flip it the other way, and if we look at cities across the U.S. and say, okay, we all want to know about the return to the office. What's actually the utilization rates at the moment? Where are people going back to the office? One of the data sources we have is Castle Systems, who, as I'm sure you know, are a property security management firm. And they've been tracking 10 metros across the U.S. and basing their data on a weekly basis on the number of card swipes in different buildings. So it's a little bit imperfect, but it's a good sort of ballpark measure. And you were talking about suburban markets, and three of the markets they track are the main Texas markets of Dallas, Houston, and Austin. And if you look at actually Castle's occupancy data for those markets, right now it's tracking about 45 to 50%. The average across the 10 markets that they track was 38% about a week and a half ago. But if you go to sort of, the San Franciscos, Chicago's, Manhattan's of this world, at a metro level, they're like 25 to 30%. But if you really drill down to the CBD areas, I think you're closer to sort of 15 or maybe now around about 20% office utilization in downtown office markets.
Yeah. When I think drilling down is important too, because like you said, I mean, those are big MSA numbers and don't tell the whole story. And that really goes to a lot of things that I'm seeing right now that I hadn't experienced in the 22 years I've been doing this, where when you're talking to any kind of investors that are looking getting into office in any of these markets, it goes so much beyond just the traditional research that used to used to go into it. There's a lot of data out there, but I'm finding that investors are really trying to understand micro markets within a city. And, yes. You know, some examples of that are within Fulton Market. If you look at some of the metrics in Fulton Market, there's a lot of product being delivered, but it's gaining. I mean, there's a lot of absorption coming into that. More companies are moving in there than ever before. But even within Fulton Market, in that small defined space west of downtown, there's even little sub micro markets within that. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see even within those what who the winners are and what some of the losers are. It could be a function of a block or two, really, in some cases.
Yeah. I think looking at some of the other cities, I'd sort of flag up Atlanta as a really good example, similar to what you were talking about in Chicago. The majority of new construction in Atlanta has been taking place in the Midtown submarket, which, as I'm sure you know, is adjacent to Buckhead. And Buckhead was always, for many, many years, basically top rents, premier location. We've seen a lot of people move into Atlanta. It's in there's obviously in that market quite a lot of latent demand for quality office product because that new space is leasing up pretty well. So again, you have that you have that sort of sub-market level difference within a major market where one is more in the ascendancy that and then maybe it's traditionally more higher rented sort of neighbor. It's interesting in Boston as well. While the Back Bay is still the premier market and will garner the highest rents, we've seen the Seaport District, which is a former real industrial area, really emerged over the last 10 to 20 years. And I think, you know, that's got quite a bit into competition with the traditional financial core of Boston as well. So you were mentioning Fulton Market, and, you know, you've got another new submarket that's emerged in recent years in another major city, this one being Boston.
Yeah. So when we're stepping outside of submarkets and even the United States, do you have much interaction and conversation with your international colleagues on research?
Yes, we put together some sort of global papers on sort of trends. I think the interesting one right now, and you know, we look on a regional basis at Europe and the Asia Pacific countries as well. And I think one of the big differences is actually just the whole how COVID impacted and what the return to office levels are. I think in a lot of Asia Pacific countries, then there wasn't really much of a fall off in office utilization rates. And certainly, you know, if I take my old home of London, for example, then, the sort of utilization rates that we're just talking about in the U.S. office markets now, that has been sort of pretty commonplace in the usage of, you know, public transport. I can speak to this just anecdotally from a friend who works in central London. She's been taking the tube, their subway, to work pretty much all through the pandemic. So I think we are behind the curve compared to most nations around the world or the major CRE markets around the world in terms of getting people back into the office.
Right. And then the Russia-Ukraine crisis, we'll see if that spills out beyond its kind of provincial place, and that could obviously have some ramifications, right?
Yes. I mean, it's difficult to sort of call any sort of quantitative impact. I think the one thing I would point to is what we have seen in the U.S. is that some of the econometric forecasting houses have been downgrading their GDP forecasts in the U.S. for this year. I was looking at Oxford Economics this morning, and I think their latest call is about 3.7%. Which is about 20 to 30 basis points down from where they were, pre the Ukraine situation. Obviously, the economic impact on, cities more in that, countries more in that region, maybe more sort of profound. But in terms of the office market in the U.S. and commercial real estate, right now, we don't perceive any sort of huge impact. I mean, obviously, there is an impact on the economy here. And we've seen an impact on interest rates as well. I think the thing to monitor, and hopefully, obviously, this doesn't happen, if there's a real escalation in the conflict, then the impact is obviously going to be greater.
Right. I mean, one could argue, you know, there's been a movement for more onshoring, and that could actually bolster more of that. And then I know, and I've got some clients in South America that do not invest in South America and they put their money in the United States. And so some of this potentially could benefit the United States from a office investment standpoint, perhaps.
Yes. I mean, if it's seen as a stable haven, then obviously that's attractive to investors.
Right. So we're about 15 days away from ending the first quarter, and you're tracking it, I'm sure, month to month. What are you seeing, any trends, or what do you expect to see by the end of this first quarter? Discernible differences between the end of the Q1?
I think that, you know, I've always said that I want to see sort of 4 quarters of consistent data before I really say that the market is sort of stabilized. You know, what I'm expecting is probably a repeat of what we saw in the fourth quarter of last year. I don't think we're certainly going to see, you know, a sizable drop in vacancy or a big tick up in absorption. But I, you know, my belief, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, I've been tracking office markets for 35 years now, is that I think the U.S., my call is that the U.S. market will continue to stabilize in the first half of this year. So more inching down in the vacancy, you know, maybe absorption ticking up a little bit. The big impact that really, you know, we don't have a quantitative number on right now is when people get back into the office. As you know, this has been such an iterative process. We can wind it back and said that we're going to get people back in the office after Labor Day last year. Then Delta came along and scuppered those plans. Then it was going to be the start of this year. And, you know, obviously Omicron came along. I think there's now actually a growing sort of confidence in as we get into the spring. And maybe this will feed more into April, May than it does over the next couple of weeks to close out March. I really do think we're going to see more people back in the office. And once we see more people back in the office, then firms are going to start to be able to address what their space needs are going forward. I think until you've got people sort of back working, it's hard to sort of say, okay, well, how much office space do I want? Where do I want it to be? What's the function of this space? And, you know, I don't think it's going to be a huge trend, but, you know, one possible thing here is that actually some of the sublease space that firms have put on the market in sort of, you know, initial reaction to COVID 18 months ago, they may start taking some of that back. And if that brings down the sublease total, and in particular if it brings down, we have less quality sublease options, then that's obviously going to be a big plus for the direct market. I think one note of caution I will put on there, and this is my sort of, you know, personal viewpoint, is that we haven't really seen much change in rents over the, you know, during this past 24 months so far. Landlords have been pretty much sticking to their asking rates. The gap between asking and effective rents has widened because, you know, more concessions, whether it's in terms of fit out allowances or rent free periods, are being sort of offered. But one of the things I'm thinking could happen as we get to a point where more firms are back in the office, let's hope obviously that the Ukraine situation doesn't escalate and we get in a position where maybe there's more business sort of confidence, then you will see the number of active tenant requirements in the market increase. You know, while leasing volume has been picking up, particularly over the last 6 months, it's still subdued in most markets compared to pre-pandemic levels. So I think there is the possibility that landlords may come off those asking rents a little bit, because once you've got real requirements in the market, then people are going to want to commit to land or retain those tenants, and there may be a little bit more sort of negotiating room for such companies.
Yeah, and there's A's and there's B and there's everyone else. There's A's, trophies, yeah, and everyone else. So the everyone else's are going to have to fight like heck to retain those tenants, in my opinion, no matter what market you're in.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a knock-on effect from that, you know, we've talked a lot about the flat quality. The other issue here is what happens to those older Class A minus, you know, B buildings? There's been a lot of talk about repurposing, I think principally to multifamily use. There are some markets, and, you know, I think we'll flag up Boston as a really good example of this, where they're converting older office properties to lab or life science use, although that comes with its own challenges. But I think there's going to be an element of the office inventory that's of an older quality, and you can't repurpose all of it. So it really gets the point at saying, as an owner, when am I confident enough in the market to put significant capital improvements into my building?
Fair assessment. Well, Stephen, this has been really insightful. I appreciate your time and your thoughts, and I look forward to seeing the next report and hopefully some more recovery for the U.S. markets. And we can touch base maybe later this year then.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. And I've really enjoyed our conversation. Let's hope that some of the indicators we've been talking about continue to move in a positive direction.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Office Space Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll catch you next time.